Dreams are like angels, they keep at it bay. Love is the light, scaring darkness away. Yeah, yeah. I'm so in love with you, purge the soul. Make love your goal. The power of love, a force from above, cleaning my soul. Flame on, burn desire, love with tons of fire. Soul, make love your goal. I'll protect you from the hooded claw, keep the vampires from your door. When the chips are down, I'll be around with my yourself. Be beautiful, sparkling love, flowers and pearls and pretty girls. Love is like an energy rushing inside of me. Flame on, burn desire, love with tongues of fire, purge the soul, make love your goal. This time we go sublime, love is entwined, divine, divine. Love is danger, love is pleasure. Love is pure, the only treasure. I am so in love with you, purge the soul. Make love your goal. The power of love, a force from the soul, make love your goal.
Hey, John.
Hello, Doreen. So good to meet you.
Thank you. I wish I could see your face better, but I can see you've got glasses on, haven't you?
Oh, it's not much to look at. You're not missing anything.
We've all, you know, what do we say, John? We've got a good head for radio. That's what we say.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, me too, really.
We've got good heads for podcasting. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well,
me too. I'll make a good avatar. Yeah.
Well, I'll just say hello and welcome to everybody for this extraordinary, in more ways than one, extraordinary podcast episode. I'm calling this one Superfan Number One. This one's a special one because I've invited Millie, but I've also invited a very, very close friend of mine, Mr. John Griffiths, who's actually on a bit of a visit from London, And he's staying actually in my house, so he's in the living room at the moment. But we're going to say we're crossing to John from London and Millie in St Anne's, and it's going to be very international, even though you're in my living room, John. So, hello and welcome. So I thought I would invite John along today for this podcast episode to join us for a bit of a discussion, a bit of a chat, just to give you a little bit of context. John and I met each other teaching in a school called Willow Tree Primary School in Northolt in 1995. And we hit it off, didn't we? John was next door to me. I was sinking fast, fumbling around and trying to get my head around a new system and a new job and a new country. And John was there, and he had my back from pretty much day one, even though you thought I looked a bit odd with my ponytail. And
he did. You're never going to let me live that down.
No, he said, what was your first impression, John? Just let me ask you that.
I just kind of thought, now there's an odd looking bloke. Because you had this long curly hair in a ponytail. You would stick thin in jeans and like a navy kind of sweater. But your glasses were stuck with sellotape, and you had this really old fashioned briefcase with you. And I thought, there's a man who screams incongruity, but oh man.
Well, that briefcase, that old fashioned briefcase was actually my father and my future father-in-law's briefcase. That was John's screen.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I am so glad I've got a connection with John Connolly. I really am. Well, feel like I know him. I really do.
Yeah.
It probably had BAE stamped on the front of it or something.
Wow. I think you're right. Yeah.
Briefcases.
Well, if it was free, it was for me. Let's just put it that way. I was so poor that I couldn't even afford to fix my spectacles. They were held together with a bit of sellotape, which I'm very humble before. So, yes, John and I worked together at Willow Tree, and John's over visiting his son who lives in Melbourne, and he's become a granddad for the first time. And he's absolutely loving it. And little Lottie is just, you should see her, Millie. She is the most unbelievably aware baby you'd ever see. You know, she's even at about 3 months, she was glued to whoever was talking, and she'd just be fixated on anything you were doing. She's incredible. She's just a bright little button. So...
John, you're going to watch yourself, aren't you, in future when she gets a bit older? She'll be holding you to account for everything.
Yeah, that's. It's amazing how the leg of having a grandchild makes you think about, that kind of thing. You know, just basically all I want to do now is stick around long enough so that I actually get to see her grow up. So I'm really hoping I'm going to get to your standard of life expectation, Doreen.
Well, I'll just tell you, you have to be careful, because my father had a wonderful dad, and occasionally he'd get exasperated, never with anybody, it was always with whatever he was doing. And when my eldest son was 2 years old, he suddenly came out with, "Oh, bugger." And everything was, "Oh, bugger." And it went on for a while. And he'd heard that from my father. So I said, "You watch your mouth, Grandad."
Oh, yeah. I'm probably in trouble then, to be honest.
Yeah, you will have to watch yourself. Yeah, that formative, that little girl's going to be very attentive. She's going to listen to everything you say, mate.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought I'd invite John along today because... John has, his family has a bit of an interesting history, sort of similar generation to yours, Millie. And John's been an avid listener of the podcast and has been pretty intrigued with your story, and make, you know, it's got drawn his own sort of comparisons to those of his parents, the lives of his parents. So I've invited him along for a chat today, and so here is a little snippet of what John had to say during our little talk with the BBC recently.
During the pandemic, many of us have looked for new ways to entertain ourselves at home and on the go. And if you're anything like me and bread making and early morning workouts aren't quite your thing, then it's likely you are amongst the thousands who tuned in to our podcast. The number of people listening to them in the last few years has gone up. And here in St Anne's, Lancashire, Doreen Connolly, a 90-year-old grandmother, affectionately known as Millie, decided to make her own.
What's absolutely fantastic to me is the knowledge I've gained from about the 40s and 50s when my parents were both children.
So, John, in that soundbite, you mention, you talk about how your mum used to talk about siren suits. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that conversation sort of would come about, and, you know, what sort of things did she say that would sort of remind you or connect you with what Millie was talking about?
Well, that particular thing was Millie would probably remember the winter of the 62 and 63, when it was a ridiculously cold winter, and there was snow, like knee-deep snow everywhere. And I just remember, because I was about the time when I got memories, that my mum and dad to take you out anywhere, if you were going outside the house, had this one-piece suit on, and she called it a siren suit. And up until I listened to the podcast, I didn't really know what a siren suit was. It never occurred to me. I thought it was something to do with the fabric. Then, of course, listening to Millie on the podcast, of course, that's what you put children in when the siren sounded, to move them to wherever you were going to go to be safe. So it was that, all of a sudden, it was like a penny dropped. Like, oh, yeah, of course, that's what it was.
So you had these in the house.
Yeah, but me and my sisters both had them, and I remember them being referred to as siren suits, kind of like one-piece zip-up suits.
So were they, do you think they were original siren suits, or do you think your mum had sort of made them in the same style as the original ones?
I would have thought mum bought them, actually, but it was just like, it was that terminology. You know, even in the 60s, there was a lot of, there was still the war cast itself over, especially the people who'd survived it, who'd been through it. It really cast them, you know, people still talked about it. It was still referenced, you know, in everywhere. And, you know, people, especially as a lot of the politicians who were around in those days, were politicians who'd been there or there.
That.
Do you,
in your experiences, did you get a feeling that politicians who had served had a bit more credibility or a bit more political clout because they had that background? Do you think it helped them?
Oh, yes. Yes, I really think so. I think people felt they'd earned their place and they'd earned their voice,
Right. So did siren suits... in your experience, Millie, did siren suits survive beyond the war? Did you keep yours? Did you have yours for some time afterwards?
Well, we all outgrew them very quickly, didn't we?
Oh, of course. Well, you were children, weren't you?
Children.
Yeah. I just wonder whether they'd become...
Winston Churchill, really, that started it off, you know. Everyone saw Winston in his siren suit and... you often saw him in his
Oh,
siren.
That's right. Yes, I remember that footage now.
It's iconic, isn't it? He's kind of he walks around in it in his siren suit, and it's
So I think because of his age, and he wasn't terribly well, I think he used to nod off now and again, you know, and he'd have to have his little, perhaps 20 minutes nod off, and then he was raring to go again.
After he'd had a whiskey or two.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Champagne was allegedly his tipple, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, John, what parallels could you make from your own life or from your parents' lives in listening to the podcast?
I think it was quite, because my mum and dad had quite different experiences, I think, from you, Doreen. It was because my mum was an evacuee. I know some people have said that they had very good experiences as evacuee. When we were young, my mum used to talk about it because she was evacuated out to a little town just outside London called Chesham and Amersham, which even to this day are really quite nice little towns. And she used to talk about roaming the countryside and watching the American bombers come back, because there were lots of, they used to waggle their wings to the children as if they saw them. And I used to think it's quite idyllic, but it was only later on when my sisters and I asked us to talk a bit more about that, and she got really upset. It turns out that she had a very, very bad time. She was moved from one family where she was fairly comfortable to one that was, well, abusive, basically. And after a while, she managed to tell us about it. But the one thing that that really shone out of that account was she managed to get in touch with her dad and tell her dad that she was unhappy. And the next thing she knew, dad had got the train, because even in those days, the tube used to go out to Chesham, had walked like the 5 or 6 miles from Chesham station and took her home that day. And she said it was the happiest day of her life. So did you know any evacuees, Doreen?
Well, yes, my cousin Una and her brother Alan. That's our mothers were sisters. And we got ready to go and had our little labels on and everything. My mother took us, because my father had already gone away then to be an evacuation officer. We didn't know where he was. And my mother took us, and actually, as the children in the school playground were getting on this big bus, she just grabbed hold of us and said, "Come on, let's run." And she ran us home.
Oh,
and she
that's
said,
lovely.
You're not going. But my cousins went to Stile, that's outside, well, it's in Cheshire. And they were at a farm. Well, the mother used to go out every 2 weeks and take goodies for them, you know, and clothes and things. And my cousin Una was a very bubbly girl. She was a few months younger than me. And so she would be 8 then. And she went very quiet and withdrawn. And so Auntie Clara was telling my mother this. And my mother said, why don't you go unannounced? Why don't you go when they're not expecting you? Because when she went, she used to sit down and have a cup of tea and a piece of cake with the farmer's wife and whatnot, you know. And so she did. And when she got there, she found out that these two children were sleeping in a barn. And Alan was being used on the farm, you know, as a as a worker. Yeah. He was he would be 10 then.
Oh, my goodness.
So she did the same. She just brought them straight home that day.
Yeah. my dad's experience was very much to yours, because my dad's mum refused to have. He had two half brothers who were serving, and two half brothers and his elder brother actually was serving, because they were like a couple of years older than him. But she flatly refused to have him and his sister evacuated. She says, "No, if we're going to die, we'll all die together." And I think that was like 1939, people were kind of expecting that, you know, the bombs were going to rain down and you were lucky if you'd make it through.
Yeah.
What a decision to make. Boy.
It was surprising that because Una's husband, Arthur, he had a wonderful time because he came from quite a poor area in Manchester and he was evacuated to Fleetwood and, you know, just north of Blackpool. And the lady that took him in was her husband was a skipper on a fishing boat. So he didn't see very much of Arthur. But she and her grown-up daughter looked after Arthur. And for years afterwards, he used to go back and see them. And he was there right till the end of the war. And he just loved them to bits. Yeah.
Mm. Kind of random, isn't it? You know, you could have two people have two very, very different stories or memories of that experience, but still very traumatic to think that, you know, look, it's a war situation, everybody has to comply, but...
Arthur was a bit of a character, you know, and he and his best friend pretended they were brothers, you see, and so they were the very last group of these children to be claimed, you know, collected. They were at the town hall, everybody else had gone. And they were looking, they kept saying, Mum says we have to stay together. Mum says we have to stay together. And they were trying to find someone who would take two boys, you see. Anyway, eventually this lady came along, said she would take them. But his friend got a bit homesick. So they decided they would go home and see the mum and then come back again. And they only had one pair of roller skates between them. So they each wore one roller skate. And they skated 5 miles before the police brought them back.
Oh, wow. What an outstanding effort. Wow.
Yeah.
At what age?
So that was typical of Arthur. He knew Arthur.
Oh, what a man. I tell you what, John, if you could have met Arthur... The stories, you'd just be in stitches. You'd sit there and you'd listen to these stories. They were absolutely hilarious. He was amazing. He was amazing.
He was a character.
But how old was he when that happened, when he did that, the Great Escape?
Well, he was older than me, so he would be 11 then. He would be 11, three years older than me.
He obviously didn't tell the people.
No, they didn't know. No, it was only when he didn't come home at tea time for his tea. And she went down to school and they said, well, they didn't come back after lunchtime. You know, there's two of them missing.
Oh, goodness.
So immediately the police were looking for these boys and she guessed that they would head for Manchester.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, they caught them in Blackpool.
So, John, what happened with your dad's side? His family, what happened there?
Well, my dad's two half brothers, Bill and Cecil. Bill went to be, he was the, a lot of the merchant navy ships at that time had guns fitted to them, and he was on the Atlantic convoys. And my dad's full brother Fred was actually did the same thing, but on the infamous Russian convoys. So, you know, they both of them had a pretty tough time. In actual fact, my Uncle Bill got shot by friendly fire. There was a guy, another serviceman, a regular, like there was, I think, six in the crew on the ship, six regular Navy guys on the merchant crew. And one of them was cleaning a rifle and didn't check to see if it was clear and shot him. And he was like, they were like 40 or 50 miles out in the north of Scotland. So they had to steam back to a port in Scotland and transfer him, but luckily made it through. But the other half brother was with the 14th Army in Burma. So he had a terrible time of it as well. And my dad was like, I suppose, like a lot of young men, because he was 3 years older than my mum. He was born in 27. So he just missed the war, but he did his national service. Like, I think your was it your brother who did it in the army of occupation?
He went in just a few months before the war finished, yes.
Yeah. Well, my dad went just literally got on November, like 2 or 3 months after the war finished, he was actually, well, he was in Denmark, first of all, on a special duty after his basic training. But I was telling Phil that he would tell you anything at all about the training and about his special duty in Denmark, but you couldn't get anything out of him about Berlin. You would not say anything at all about Berlin.
A lot of them were like that, weren't they? And my brother was in Egypt, and my husband didn't go his national service. He only had a few months in, and he just did air traffic control still in England at an air station.
My dad said that he never took his leave in his last year when he was stationed in Berlin because he wouldn't have gone back again. So he was entitled, I think, to 2 weeks leave, but he didn't take it because he thought he just knew he wouldn't go back again. So I know the situation was terrible for the people in Berlin. But what did you actually think about the? I mean, you must have seen newsreels about the destruction in the German cities. What did you think about that? What happened to them?
Well, I heard about it firsthand because my cousin was a quartermaster sergeant. And he was in Berlin, of course, after the war. He was there for 2 years after the war. And he married a German girl.
She
was quite a bit younger than him. She was the same age as me, you see, when the war finished, 14. But she came over. He brought her over to see us a few times before they married. And she told me that she lived in Berlin. And the house was gutted, but the cellar was intact. So they lived in the cellar, she and her mother and her brother. And her father did come, he was a prisoner of the Russians, and he was lucky to get home. But when he came home, her mother tried to kill him because she thought he was
a
vagrant trying to get into where they were living, you know, in the cellar. And she got hold of something hard and started trying to hit him. She didn't recognise him. She said he was like a scarecrow, you know.
They were treated terribly.
But he used to go to the club, the British club they had. And she wasn't a prostitute or anything. She was just a young kid, you know. And she'd go there and dance with them. And she said nobody harmed her. And they were always giving her cigarettes. And she pretended to smoke, but she didn't smoke. She put them in her pocket. Because the following day, her mother would use those to go and buy food, you see. They were currency. Cigarettes were currency.
I remember you saying in one of the podcasts, Doreen, about the rationing in post-war Britain and how there was like a resentment that there was food being sent to Germany. Did that ever soften at all as it became clear that you know, it wasn't clear cut, that the Russians weren't going to be everyone's friend? And that
you just hear a few people grumble, but the majority of them didn't really resent the Germans, you know. Although you'd get people saying, you know, they bombed my chippy and things like that, and then have a bit of a laugh, you know. Don't like the Germans, they bombed my chippy. You know, but I don't think there was real resentment. Well, you can tell my cousin died. He was shot down and a prisoner of war, and something happened and he never came back. But we do know that he was a prisoner of war. He landed safely because one of his friends came to visit his mother later and didn't know he'd died, thought he'd survived. You see, he was only a sergeant gunner, and his friend, of course, was the pilot.
Oh, okay.
So he went to a different area.
Was this Buddy, Dory?
Yes, Buddy, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
and it was Buddy's brother that married the German girl.
Oh, okay.
But Aunt Nellie never resented her. She made her welcome, and I thought that was wonderful, really, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you consider what has probably happened to Buddy, really.
The crew landed safely, parachuted, you know, they were shot down. Only one of them died, and that was the last his friends saw of him. So later on after the war, he went to visit, popped in, and he sat there having a cup of tea with Aunt Nellie. And he said, "So what time does the lad get home?" And she said, "Oh, which one?" She'd four sons, you know. And he went, "Well, Buddy." And well, she looked absolutely staggered, you know. She said, "Buddy never came home. He died."
Oh,
that must have been all too common. That people would look for their friends or not know.
Yeah,
you know.
And also, his brother did find his grave. He found his grave, and I've got a photograph of his grave, and that was hundreds of miles away from where they'd parachuted down.
Mm. It'd be
so. He's wondering whether they used him for. Well, they used them as slave labor. Some of them, didn't they?
Yeah.
And also they had what they call that long march. Towards the end of the war, they started marching the prisoners away towards the east, you know. Well, Lord knows why they did that. And I know a lot of them died then on the march.
Mm. Well, that's what you and I were talking about the other night, wasn't it? Because you asked me that question. Mm. You said, did the family ever really find out what had happened to Buddy?
Mm. No, we didn't.
Yeah,
no.
There wasn't. Yeah. Well, you know, if Buddy had succumbed during that march, if that happened, then other people would have had the same thing happen to them, wouldn't they? So,
oh, it did. Yes. Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's hope we don't have another.
Dreams are like angels, they keep bad at bay. Love is the light, scaring darkness away. Yeah, yeah. I'm so in love with you, purge the soul. Protect you from the hooded claw, keep the vampires from your door. When the chips are down, I'll be around with my undying, death-defying love for you. Envy will hurt itself, let yourself be beautiful, sparkling love. It's like an energy rushing in, rushing inside of me. This time we go sublime. Love is entwined, divine, divine. Love is danger, love is pleasure. Love is pure, the only treasure. I am so in love with you, purge the soul. Love with tongues of fire, purge the soul.